Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Commerce to order. We got a couple of things I want to take care of. Housekeeping to make sure we've got a very large group here. We're running a little bit behind. Just for everyone's information, all five of the members on this committee, including myself, all serve on judiciary, and so that's why we have a staggered start time. Unfortunately, we ran up to the last minute in judiciary, and so we have members coming and going. Hopefully, we'll have all five of us here at some point. We have five bills that are scheduled for public hearing and possible work session today. I'm going to start with just saying announcement on Senate Bill 944. That is going to more than likely not take testimony today because I believe we're going to be pretty well backed up on what we have before that. If time permits, meaning if we clear the docket or the agenda before 5 o'clock, then I will open it up for those who might want to stay around. There will be another public hearing. I've already had one member who's requested that. So if you want to leave, feel safe that you'll have another opportunity, but you're more than welcome to participate and join in on the other four, and then wait and see if we have enough time. So those for 944, either today, late, or at another time in the very near future, we'll have that rescheduled. Regarding the other bills, I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing at this point on Senate Bill 311. We have a set of amendments that have come in to us. I'm going to have council go over a little bit with us, and then I understand because of how this has been worked, we're going to have a few individuals come forward who were part of that work group, and then we'll start in on others who want to give testimony. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 311 requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules regulating required medical examinations and workers' compensation claims. We have no revenue impact. It will have a fiscal impact, I understand. We don't have a fiscal statement yet. We recommend a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I believe John Schultz from the Workers' Compensation Division will speak to why that's so. We have amendments today. I was barely able to get through them. We got them 20 minutes ago. So they're new to us all, and I believe John Schultz will be speaking to the amendments as well today.
Okay, what I'm going to ask is, based on what I've been told, I know we have Ken Hector and John Schultz here. I'd like for y'all to please come forward. And who else was it? Was it
Ken Hector and JL.
All right, and JL, if you'll also please come up, the three of you. And as you're coming up, I guess the other thing I want to state on the Senate Bill 311, since we do have the dash ones, they have just been released. I am not expecting people to have all of the understanding as to what they may include. You can sit there and read as much as you can and give your testimony, your presentation as it with the dash ones as a possible introduction into the committee. What I hope that you will not do is two things. Number one, sit up here and read and try to go through it and make us aware of what's happening. We're still working on it, and so what I need you to do is give your testimony as you want to give it, specifically as to what you know. If you don't know and you're signed up, you can just say that you haven't had the time to go through the dash ones, and that way it won't put you in an awkward position or keep us in an awkward one either. So with that said, thank you very much for understanding. And gentlemen, whoever's going to start off, we'll let you go ahead and choose. And
Chair Prezanzi, members of the committee, my name is J.L. Wilson, co-chair of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, the full committee that's taken a look at Senate Bill 311 and recommended it at this point for passage. We charted a course for the outstanding comp issues that we were going to deal with over the interim that included independent medical exams, PTDs, permanent total disabilities, and voc rehab. Senate Bill 311 is the independent medical exam portion of that three-part agenda. Now, for our purposes, when you last met, there were three outstanding issues that I believe have been resolved on this PTD issue, the first of which is what we are going to do with workers who failed to show up for their exams. We decided to defer to the department and give them latitude to determine sanctions for workers who failed to show up. There was also the issue of sanctions for doctors who did not forward the relevant materials on to the independent medical examiner. In the same vein, we also deferred to the department to come up with sanctions in those instances where those materials and diagnostics weren't forwarded to the independent medical examiner in a timely fashion. And second and third, we dealt with the time and place issue, and how we resolved that is we basically allowed an injured worker to appeal the location of the exam to the department for dispute resolution. And we felt that those three issues were the final three. That's not to say that the bill is perfect. I, for one, from a management point of view, have yet to see a system cost impact of this bill, which is very essential for my support. But in good faith, we negotiated this in good faith. For purposes of this committee, I think it warrants passage today. And so I urge that from you, and we'll leave it at that.
JL, thank you. We'll go ahead and take testimony from the three, and then we'll open up for questions. Whoever wants to go second.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Schultz. I'm the administrator for the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I've provided you with written testimony about SB 311. I'll try to follow your earlier guidelines and not read my testimony to you, but just cover what I think would be important. I'd also suggest, Mr. Chair, that you'd have Mr. Bob Shifrak join us, because he could give the labor side of working on this bill as well.
What we'll do is, after the three have finished, we'll bring Bob up to give him an opportunity, then do questions if that would be best.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Dash 1 amendments to this bill include several recommendations from the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee from the original SB 311, which was a committee bill from the Senate Interim General Government Committee. The original bill was different in several respects, and I'll try to touch on what the amendments do to change the original bill. You've got my written testimony as well. Please feel free to ask me any question that I can help with. If you've got the amendments in front of you, the Dash 1 amendments, and as I think Anna mentioned, the committee administrator, Ms. Braun, mentioned earlier today, we just got these this afternoon, so I know there's lots of people who haven't had a chance to really look at them, as well as I know you noted that. I'll try to touch on the important amendments, starting with line 4 of the amendments. An important concept that differs from the original bill is that the Board of Medical Examiners was identified as the group to do the oversight, certification, training of the independent or required medical examiners. What this bill does is change that to the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So it's a fundamental change in the thrust of the bill in terms of who would be doing the oversight of this group of examiners. On line 7 of the amendments, it directs the director to adopt rules applicable to medical examinations that are conducted under this subsection of the law, which is the required medical examination section of the law. And it provides that a worker has the opportunity to request an administrative review of the place selected for the examination. JL had mentioned that as one of his points, his first point, that we needed to talk about, as well as on line 14, section large B indicates that the director shall adopt rules that would impose a monetary penalty against a worker who fails to attend a required examination without prior notification or without justification for not attending the examination. The penalty imposed on this would be only on workers who are not receiving temporary disability benefits, or those would be their wage replacement benefits. It would also only be imposed on an offset of any future compensation payable to the worker to recover the penalty imposed in this subparagraph. So it would be similar to other components of the workers' compensation law, where you can, if there was an overpayment, you can take it out of future payment. Now, what those, the amount of the monetary penalties would be set by rule. The conversation through the Management Labor Advisory Committee process identified that the issue at play here is that workers who don't show up for examinations, who don't notify, and they don't have justification for not coming to the examination, can be a very expensive no-show fee, up to $1,200 for the insurer. The idea is not to impose the entire fee on the worker. The idea is to impose a small fee on the worker to provide the worker with motivation to attend the examination, and they'd have notification of that. Going to page 2 of the amendments, on line 1, an amendment to 311, it also imposes a sanction against a medical service provider that unreasonably fails to provide in a timely manner diagnostic records required for an examination. The issue here came out of a study, and we've talked about that before with the committee, that many of the examiners in the required medical examinations were not getting diagnostic records, the original diagnostics to look at. And this is trying to provide some sort of motivation here. This is part of the section we talked about above where we would be adopting rules to do this. So exactly what that would be would come out of the administrative rule process. On line 13 on page 2, again, there's direction for the director to adopt rules applicable to medical examinations, the required medical examinations, and it's more authority under, I believe, if I'm going to look at this right, excuse me. Yes, it's under a sunset provision that exists under existing law because of a bill last session where we provided nurse practitioners with expanded responsibilities that sunset after 4 years unless the legislature takes action on that. So there's quite a bit of repeat in the amendments running through page 2 and the top of page 3. Going to page 3 on line 9 where it starts in bold letters in section 3 and jumping down to line 12, little A, the director is again directed to adopt by rule standards for certification of workers, certification of workers' compensation that shall, claims examiners that shall be administered by workers' compensation insurers, self-insured employers, and third-party administrators to develop or approve any training curriculum used by insurers, self-insured employers, or third-party administrators that's related to conducting medical exams required in this section. Again, required medical exams. What that is about is giving the department authority to approve of training ahead of time and to have the authority to do that. There's also a provision below that on starting on line 23 on page 3 that the director may impose a civil penalty against any insurer, self-insured employer, or third-party administrator who fails to maintain or produce certification and training records or to provide training that's based on the approved curriculum. So it's an authority and a civil penalty provision. Going to page 4, and I'm jumping down to line 12, I'm trying to hit the highlights of the bill here, of the amendments, is that the director, again, must establish by rule the list of the certified physicians, the grounds for their removal from the list, an appeals process for a physician who disagrees with any action taken by the director under the rules adopted. And what that is about is really it's getting to the heart of the bill. It's giving the director authority to create a list of certified physicians who can provide required medical examinations. And it basically talks about not just the authority to have the list, but the director has grounds for can produce rules for grounds for removal from the list as well as an appeals process for a physician. And we have both management and labor here, and I think they can talk about this. But one of the things I thought was very important about the management and labor process that went into producing this bill is very early in the process, this agreement was made that this needed to occur, and both management and labor were backing this action or amendment, I should say. Jumping down to sections 6, 7, and 8, which are at the end of the amendments, I wanted to touch on these because it goes to the operative and applicability dates. Section 5, again, which is where the heart of the activity occurs in this bill, becomes operative on July 1st, 2006. So we have quite a bit of time to get the certification process established, get the education and training materials ready to go, and it'll take some time to get that in front of physicians and get them certified. So this provides, we think, plenty of opportunity for the department to produce the certification process and get it rolling. Section 7 allows the director to take any action before the operative date listed in Section 5 of the Act that's necessary to enable the director to exercise the duties, powers, and functions conferred on the director by this Act. So while some of this doesn't become operative till July 1st, that gives us the authority to get going on it right away, basically. Section 8 finally says that the amendments to 656325, and that's the section that talks about required medical exams, and 656780, by the first three sections of this Act, apply to all claims in which a medical examination that's required under 656325 is scheduled on or after the effective date of this 2005 Act. So that's basically saying this is going to apply to workers who are scheduled for required medical examinations after this the effective date of the Act, rather than applying to workers for date of injury or some other triggering date. And I'd be happy to answer any questions I can, Mr. Chair.
All right. Mr. Hicker.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Hector. I'm also a member of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. I also served as one of the co-chairs of the subcommittee on Senate Bill 311. You may recall that at an earlier time, fellow co-chair Lon Holston and I provided the initial testimony, and at that time we did advise you that there were a few points that were left to be resolved, and I believe we followed up a letter with you indicating that we had resolved those issues. Mr. Wilson has advised that we have, in fact, done that, and I would just simply like to apologize that based on our meeting schedule and the fact that those recommendations had to be worked out at the full MLAC, we weren't able to get them back to LC so they could be back to you in one piece. The only other thing I would add is in an attempt to clear up any confusion or concern with respect to one of the new points in the bill, which is the certification process and registry for qualified required medical examination physicians that the Workers' Compensation Division would handle. That process will not include any medical protocols of any kind. That registry is simply that education is not about medicine. This has nothing to do with the practice of medicine. The registry and certification would only be to educate the physicians about the workers' compensation process, not in any way touch on what is rightfully the domain of the Board of Medical Examiners or the OMA. And we just want to make it clear that it's only to educate physicians who want to do IMEs about the specific nuances of workers' compensation law, and that's it.
Okay.
Happy to answer the questions.
Let me just ask before we start questions, would it be helpful for us to have Bob Sheriff give his comments now before we open up to the panel, or can we do this and then we can have Bob come up after that?
Mr. Chair, I believe it would be helpful.
Bob, if you wouldn't mind coming up, we can probably squeeze another chair. There should be a loose one around there.
Real quick.
Okay.
I've heard that before.
It's a nice day out there. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Shiprack, Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council, and co-chair of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. I'm going to be very brief and just touch on just one aspect that wasn't mentioned, and maybe the committee's already read the report that was developed by the department. If you haven't got that briefing, I would encourage the committee to look at that. One of the things that we do is ask for studies of problem areas of the system, and this issue of insurer medical exams has been around here as long as I've been here, and I think the legislation is long, long overdue. Every session there have been discussions about these examinations, and based upon factual data that we finally collected, I think it is borne out that it weren't these problems or concerns were not just perceptions, they were reality, and I think this bill will help bring more honesty and integrity to the system and be helpful for both employers and employees for our system. So applaud this effort. This is, it's going to make a big change in the system.
Great. Thank you.
Very important. Thank you.
Senator Wissett.
Yes, thank you, Dr.
Hector back up?
Hmm?
Did you want Mr. Hector
yes,
back up?
Chair Pazanski, Mr. Hector, is it your understanding that this bill will in no way, create the ability or the authority for the for this agency to sanction physicians in any way?
Chair Pazanski, Senator Whitsitt, I guess first of all we'll look at the definition of sanctions. There's a provision in it that says they could remove a physician from the certification list of examiners. In that sense, I guess that would be a sanction.
They could limit their practice then?
They could limit them from the practice of IMEs, which is again is a voluntary practice.
I think this bill should be better called a preemption of the Board of Medical Examiners law. I really think that that this agency is impinging on that ground that the Board of Medical Examiners has traditionally done and has done a good job of, and I'm having trouble getting my hands around why we should create this authority in another agency.
Chair Pazanski, Senator Whitsitt, I certainly wouldn't presume to debate the efficacy of the Board of Medical Examiners. They are the appropriate body to deal with regulatory and disciplinary matters with physicians. On the other hand, workers' compensation is a state-mandated system. There are specific laws and rules, and we don't... the Workers' Compensation Division would not be dealing with medical treatment. In fact, IME physicians do not provide medical services per se. They specifically, when they do an IME exam, state that there was no patient relationship established and that they provide no medical treatment. So in that sense, the Workers' Compensation Division would not be telling in any way a physician how to practice. What the workers' compensation could do, I guess, at the outside in way of a sanction is if a physician was not willing to follow workers' compensation rules and the Board of Medical Examiners was unwilling to deal with that. And frankly, it's been my experience with the BME that they deal with far more serious concerns, and I don't mean to minimize any issue about an independent medical exam, but it seems to me that the types of actions that the BME takes are quite serious in nature, as opposed to a more technical thing about the conduct of an independent medical exam.
Chair Pazanski, the basic tenet of medical practice is diagnosis. And that's precisely what the IME is doing, is he is making a diagnosis to confirm or deny a condition. So he is practicing medicine, and that is the basic tenet of practicing medicine. You don't ever treat the patient, hopefully, until you have made a diagnosis.
I can't disagree with that.
Thank you.
Mr. Hector, if I can just follow up with that. It's my understanding what this does from the original bill, it basically substitutes the agency, the director, to basically oversee the regulations of how IMEs are conducted and making sure that everyone's on the same page as to what the standard will be. Anything that's dealing with the basis of medical treatments that's given or lack thereof or any disciplinary issues that might be based in medicine, I would assume stays with the Board of Medical Examiners.
Chair Pazanski, I believe that is absolutely on point. That is our position.
And so really what we're trying to do is maintain, as you said, within the state system where the state agency that is over the workers' comp, in this case IME, has the ability to make certain everyone's on the same page, the same framework, but clearly if there's something that dealt with an allegation of something on the inappropriate process or practice of medicine, that would stick with the Board of Medical Examiners. I mean, what I guess the bottom line is we're not going to see the department coming in and trying to sanction a doctor. Basically, what I hear is either they're complying with what's required. If there's needs to have medical expertise, you'd refer back to the medical board examiners. And if it's determined someone's not within the guidelines of this practice, they may not be able to continue to practice in this area.
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I'd like to address that question.
That'd be great.
Again, John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, for the record. I think that's very close to correct, Mr. Chair, with just a couple of corrections. One would be that if there was a complaint brought forward by a worker to the Workers' Compensation Division about something that might have occurred at an examination, we would, as we do now, probably conduct a basic investigation to determine whether or not that possibly occurred and whether or not a referral to the Board of Medical Examiners is the right thing to do. We have done that in the past, and we have had discussions with the Board of Medical Examiners about this bill, and they've got the procedures and the process already set up for the disciplinary process, if that is what is necessary. So we would continue that sort of referral. But as Mr. Hector pointed out, there are two things that I think the committee should be aware of that could be one is specifically named a sanction and one could be considered a sanction. One is that the bill does impose a obligation on the director to impose a sanction against a medical service provider that unreasonably fails to provide in a timely manner diagnostic records required for an examination. So going back to Senator Witsit's question initially, I think that is a specific sanction that's in the bill, Senator. Secondly, as Mr. Hector pointed out, the ability of the director to maintain the list of certified providers and remove a physician from the list of certified providers based on complaints and investigation and actions by the Board of Medical Examiners, as well as advice that we would get from the Oregon Medical Association and the Medical Advisory Committee for Workers' Compensation, which is part of the process here. Then I think that could be considered a sanction against a physician if you're removed from a list of service providers. So I hope that answers your specific questions.
All right, and I am going to follow up on another thing. Is there anything under this legislation or under existing regulations that would keep a injured worker from going directly to the Board of Examiners and filing a complaint against a physician if he or she thought they had been mistreated or diagnosed or whatever in the field of medicine?
Mr. Chair, no, there isn't. However, one of the things that we found out in our survey is that workers don't know where to go with complaints. Mm-hmm. There's no real process in place for many workers. They're not advised. They often don't know what to do. And so practically, the answer is yes. But practically, I would say some workers don't know that and don't know where to go. And we found there was a large number of complaints and concerns raised about that very issue in our survey.
So, and in following up with that, John, it's my understanding that in adopting the rules that would implement SB 311 if it should pass and was signed by the governor, those type of issues could, in fact, and will be taken care of through the rule process, making sure that individuals know what their rights are, how they could in fact follow any type of complaint if that's appropriate, but they would have that information and knowing how to do that.
Mr. Chair, that is exactly correct, yes.
Go right ahead.
Chair Brzezinski, Ms. Schultz, could that same information be made available to the workers without this law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Witsit, I believe that we have the I think we have the authority under the under our administrative rules to order that now, specifically on notices of or required medical examinations or independent medical examinations, whichever people prefer to call them. But I would have to check for sure on that, and I'd like to be able to get back to you on the answer to that question if I could, Senator.
Thank you. Two other questions, if I could, John. When you went through the review of the dash ones, I'm wondering on page 1, line 14, this is the part about where there could be a monetary penalty against a worker who failed to attend a required examination. Could you please remind me as to what type of notice the worker receives as to the appointment that they have been given? So, I guess I want to make certain that there's not the potential for the injured worker to not be notified and then basically be sanctioned, or what would happen under that type of situation?
Mr. Chair, part of the process in deciding what we needed to amend in the statute versus what we need to amend in the rules was around that very discussion. And part of the rules process that we must attend to is to take a look at required notification for workers, making sure that we advise them fully of their rights as well as their responsibilities. And there is some variation in that in some of the letters we have looked at. I think it's done fairly well throughout the system now, but I think we can tighten that down and ensure that we are advising workers of their responsibilities very clearly and consistently, regardless of which insurer or third-party administrator is sending out the letter.
Okay. And I think the last thing I'm supposed to ask you for the record is about the fiscal. I understand that you might be able to address that.
Mr. Chair, yes, and we do not have a fiscal from Legislative Fiscal Office yet, so everything that I'm going to say here is just very preliminary. It's based on the department's work thus far in trying to determine what the impact of this law is going to be on the Workers' Compensation Division in terms of being able to meet many of these new mandates. They're basically, we think there will be a fiscal impact from this bill. We think it's going to vary between about $525,000 to about $630,000 per biennium in terms of FTE that are needed to carry out these responsibilities. And we think it breaks into three basic areas. One is the area requiring certification for these physicians, as well as the continuing education, maintaining the list, following up on the preliminary investigations of complaints, doing the training, really pretty much the heart of the process. We feel that we can do that with one professional level staff and one support staff to help us perform those responsibilities. The second area would be to allow injured workers to appeal the location of the required medical examination. And that was part of the initial bill, I believe, on SB 311, and it continues to be part of the bill. The issue here is that there was quite a bit of concern expressed both in front of the Interim General Government Committee as well as in the survey about workers having to travel long distances for independent medical examinations, and sometimes repeatedly having to travel long distances for more than one examination. The idea is to give workers a chance to appeal the location of their examination and have an expedited appeal process through the division so we could get that done very quickly and not delay the workers' examination if it needs to be carried out at that distance. And there's going to be times where travel is going to be required. We are a predominantly rural state. There's not going to be specialists available in every place in this state. So what we have determined to do this, we expect that there's, and again, this is our initial finding, we expect about 750 appeals per year on this issue alone. There's over 15,000 of these examinations that are carried out. That's if 5% of the workers appeal the location of their exams. And we found that there was a fairly high rate of workers who were having to travel more than 100 miles for these examinations. It was actually quite a high rate. So we think we're actually being somewhat conservative here. We feel that we can carry out this function with one full-time and one part-time professional staff. So it'd be 1.5 FTE to carry out that responsibility. Finally, the third area is the area of adopting the rule as well as providing for monetary penalties against injured workers who don't attend required medical examinations. And we have to establish, did they not have justification? Did they not make the call? There may be justification why they don't attend. We expect that there's going to be approximately 700 of these cases per year, and we have determined that we're going to need to do a short investigation on those cases as well as write an order at the end of that investigation in many of these cases. And our preliminary estimate at this time is 2 full-time professional staff as well as a half-time professional staff to carry that out. So 2.5 FTE for that piece.
Okay. Thank you for the kind of the overview. I think it would probably be best for us to wait to get the physical, then we'll have the specifics if we need to.
Mr. Chair, I would agree completely.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I've been in and out of the hearing, so if you've already answered these questions or addressed this, just let me know and I can go back and listen on the record. A couple things. One, there seems to be a lot of rule adopting rather than putting the stuff into statute. And I don't know if you've commented on that or not already, but it seems to me that a lot of this maybe should be statute rather than rule. So, and I know that when John Mnuchin talked to me, apparently I didn't catch how much of it was rule and how much of it was statute. I know when you first came and talked to us from the when Mr. Hector and whoever else it was, when you first came and talked, we went over it. So stuff that could be done by rule, but the rest of it was listed to be done in statute, but now the statute is saying adopt rules. So it seems like rather than do it in statute, you are just authorizing the department to do it by rule. Any comments?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski and Senator Beyer. I can tell from the two issues that we recently resolved with regard to sanctions against the physicians and sanctions against injured workers, there wasn't a clean agreement that we could come up to. In other words, there wasn't a clean sanction that we could come up with that didn't put the screws to one party or another. And so we felt that because those were kind of fluid situations, that it was best resolved kind of at the ground level by rule. And believe me, I share the same level of discomfort. I want to see things in statute, but I was persuaded that you could really only tackle the problem or achieve what we wanted to achieve in terms of expediting the IME process if you just took it closer to the stakeholders by virtue of the rule process and fleshed that out. I just think a statutory solution would be clumsy at best.
Well, I guess I would argue that we are closer to the stakeholders than unelected bureaucrats are. So I guess I would disagree with that premise right up front. So that's a concern I have. I don't think it's a deal killer. It's a concern I have. And the other issue is there's been a lot of confusion for me, and you just said it again, IME. To me, IME means an independent medical examination. I know there's a rule from the department that means it says it's an insurer's medical examination, and now I see it being referred to as a required medical examination. I was wondering if that's been talked about at all. I think it should be an independent medical examination, but yet I don't see that anywhere in the bill or in where it's been broached.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski and Senator Beyer. I'm just reading Chapter 656325, which alludes to required medical exams. I think, you know, basically I use the word independent, and I know my friend Mr. Shiprack uses the word insure. I just think it probably depends on what side of the equation you're on.
But was there any agreement, was there any discussion of that issue, and was it not? Because I know in statute, in one place, it's referred to as independent medical examination. Everywhere else, it's just referred to as medical examination or required medical examination. That's current law without any changes. It seems to me we need to get some clarification on what IME or REME means and what it is going to be called from here on out. I'd like to have, and maybe we need Mr. Shiprack up here to talk about it also. I don't know. From the MLAC position.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski and Senator Beyer. It was not a topic of discussion over the course of the entire bill. It just wasn't a sticking point.
Chair, I'd like clarification. JL, you're part of the MLAC.
Correct, co-chair. Yes.
Okay. Mr. Hector, you are too.
Yes, Senator.
And Mr. Shiprack. So I guess I think what I'm seeing here at the table, we have both management and labor here, and correct?
We're both on the management side.
Management and labor.
Yeah.
It's my understanding that everyone understands the need to have the flexibility. You feel comfortable working within the administrative rule process to make this happen. I assume that everyone would be willing to make sure that we know whether it's working or not working and what, if any, other steps need to be taken once it's put in place.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. I believe if there's an egregious error one way or another, you're going to hear about it through the rulemaking process. And my fundamental belief was there was just not a clean solution to be had on both issues of sanctions. And it just seemed where the department was actually in the process of day-to-day administration of this, that they could perhaps negotiate a clean solution that we would probably not be able to come to over the course of some meetings and a session. So, you know, it's one of those things I reluctantly agreed to, but it's kind of a 55-45 decision. Better judgment tells me that that's probably what you ought to do.
And I guess the only thing I would comment and want to make sure I understood from the testimony is that everyone was at the table. Who's been at the table has been there in good faith, and I expect that everyone that's participated believes this is going to continue through the rulemaking process. Is that a fair statement?
Thank you, Chair Przanski. I agree.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. And we will also be participating in the rule process, so this will not end here, and we will ensure that there's that mutual input, and hopefully the output will be something that works for everyone.
All right, let me just see if anyone else has questions for this panel.
Just one single question. Mr. Schultz, how many valid complaints does the department receive per biennium regarding the quality or validity of an IME examination?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I would have to get back to you on the answer to that question. Senator, I don't have that information with me. I can provide quite immediately information from our survey in regard to that issue, but I think you're asking for something different, Senator, and you need to know perhaps what we've experienced over the last 3 to 5 years in terms of complaint process.
Yes.
Okay.
Verified complaints, yes.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. I heard found it, ones that are actually have reached as compared to just complaints being filed.
Actually, yes. Verified quality and validity complaints regarding IME examination.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I'll step back. What I'm going to do is I've looked at the list of what I have before us of the individuals who want to testify. What I'm going to try to do is get what I would consider the more citizen types as compared to individuals that are representing either groups or lobbyists, since just in case we run out of time. I do have a couple of people that are here together. What I'm going to ask is that whatever your testimony is, hopefully it will be different if you're going to testify together instead of being repetitive. The first panel will be Jackie Schoen, Stuart Schoen, and I believe David Allen.
I'm Jackie.
Hi, Jackie.
Stuart.
Hello, Stuart. And is David Allen still here? Mr. Allen, thank you. Why don't we go ahead and start with, I'll just start on this side if it's all right. Stuart, if you'll give us your name and then give us your testimony, please.
My name is Stuart Schoen. I don't really have a prepared statement. I'm not exactly sure if this pertains to this hearing or not. It's basically about the treatment I had received during IMEs, some of the reporting discrepancies in the IMEs. There were certain problems and discrepancies as far as the reports and what other doctors were saying or stating in other reports. I had read that there were mention of canned reports. I had an IME by one doctor who's basically been using the same statement over and over again for the last 10 years. I had another IME by a doctor who turned around and stated that I didn't even have an injury, even though it was proved, and even though two of the other doctors that had worked for the same company that had done an IME had turned around and stated that this injury did exist. Again, I didn't have time to prepare a statement. I wish I had.
Stuart, if I could ask you, if you'd be so kind, if you might want to get a copy of the bill as well as the amendments, and if you have an opportunity to review it, and if you want to give written testimony and submit it to us as to the changes. I hope that you understand what we're looking at is what, if any, changes should be made to the current system. And we've had a panel that presented what they think might be a way to help, say, make the process more fair and having some type of regulation within that process. So one of the things I think for all of us on this committee we would appreciate is for those who maybe experienced, as you have, what your input would be as to whether you think these are changes. It seems to me that what I'm hearing you say is that you think something needs to be changed based on what your experience was. What we're hoping is what was being brought to us will, in fact, maybe get us in that path. So at some point in the future, if you have that opportunity, that would be wonderful.
Yes, if you have a copy of the bill and the amendments, I'd like to give a written testimony.
Okay, and we probably have that available in the back, except for maybe the bill. If necessary, we can always get copies and bring some up. In fact, I'd ask Karen if you could make arrangements to have someone go down to publications, get a set of the printed bill itself, the 311, and we can put it on the back table for those who don't have it now. That'd be great. Thank you. Let's see. Jackie Chung?
Yes, my name is Clark.
I need you to identify yourself just for the record so we know it's on tape, and then if you'll tell us what you'd like to say.
Okay. My name is Jackie Schoen, and I attended all the IMEs with my husband as a witness, and I'm glad that I did. One thing that Stuart did not point out, his claim's already been closed, but it's been settled. But what we went through in the process was heinous. It was absolutely pathetic. The treatment was pathetic. The reports were filled with inaccuracies. And we came forward, hopefully, to save someone else from going through the same process that we went through by making people at the government level aware of these problems. And everything that we have in these files are documentations of errors and the three IMEs that we did go through. So everything is very well documented. It's not that we decided to show up today and just vent.
Right.
And so if this hearing is not the appropriate time to do it, that's fine. But we still would like to present this to the appropriate people so they are aware of what injured workers go through.
All right. Michelle, just to let you know, we've heard from others that have been injured workers. That mm-hmm. have given us. We had an interim work group or a committee that the general government that took this issue on during the past interim. Mm-hmm. And so we had a lot of that, and that's what really has caused these bills to move forward.
Uh-huh.
And so at this point, not to say that we don't want to hear your story as to the particulars that your husband went through. If you want to provide that information to my administrator, that's fine.
Okay.
But at this point, what we're now trying to do is, based on what we knew and what we learned from the interim period, mm-hmm. as how we how some people perceive IMEs, we're now seeing what, if any, fix that we can make.
Right.
And that's what the dash ones with the bill will do. So maybe between you and your husband, if you look at that, see what's happening, mm-hmm. if you have comments on that, based on your experience, that would be beneficial for myself at least.
Okay, that would be fine.
Okay, thank you both. Let me ask if either of you, if anyone has any questions for the Schoens. All right, and Mr. Allen.
Yes, my name is David Allen, and I'm presently going through a claim now. I totally agree with what they said, but it has nothing to do with what's going on right now. I'd like to first address the training of the IMEs, you know, how are they trained and who is training them and why do they need training? They're doctors. Aren't they already trained? Shouldn't they be able to come up with their own idea of what's wrong with a worker? Okay, the penalties, your late penalties that you said, I totally agree with that. If somebody doesn't make a meeting or if there's a MIR that's not MRI that's not there in time, I totally agree with that. But as far as traveling to and from your IMEs, I've got several friends out in Eastern Oregon, and they've all been ordered to drive to Portland to come to an IME. Well, some of them are blue-collar workers, and their checks have been stopped. They have no money for gas. You know, the cars are kind of substandard. And they can't drive all the way from Portland or from, say, Pendleton out here to Portland to make an IME where there's totally adequate, enough trained doctors right there in their own community. Why isn't the Workman's Comp Board taking the reports from these already trained doctors? They're already, so they're not on some list someplace. You know, isn't their word just as good as an IME's word? And causing somebody to travel, especially somebody with, you know, take for instance my back. There's no way in the world I could travel all the way from Eastern Oregon in a car to come to an IME. You know, it would just kill me. And so I think some of these things, you know, taking, even though the doctor may not be on the list, you made comments that the director has the right to discharge or place another doctor on the list. I believe Portland's not the only city in this state. There's other places in Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon that, you know, these other doctors can be added to the list. And there should be more people, not just whether they're on the list or not, but if they're a certified doctor in the field of which the injury is in, it should be more taken at heart. You know, their ideas of what's wrong should be, it should hold more. You know, you understand what I mean. It should hold more clout. Okay, and the other thing I really wanted to say was, let's see. Well, the IMD doctors themselves, you know, the training and who is training them. And, okay, you send me to an IMD doctor. Okay, I've got a back problem. Is this guy, does he even know anything about a back? Or is he a foot doctor? On your list, it doesn't matter. He's just an IME, you know. And you mentioned, I believe the one gentleman mentioned, education over medical. Well, aren't they medical doctors? I believe, you know, the medical aspect should come up way beyond, you know, whatever their credentials are, you know, especially in a specializing field. You know, you're sending somebody with a back problem to a foot doctor, you know, just, and then he... They have no idea. And the other thing I really want to say is, like, my attending physician, I went and found a back specialist. I was told by the first IME to go out and find yourself a back specialist. And what they turn around and write back in their reports, it's almost comical what they, you know, send back to, well, Safe Corporation, you know. It's almost comical what they write back to them. You know, here the doctor, the IME doctor, actually told me to go find a specialist, that I have two disc protrusions in my lower back, and the only thing that's going to fix it is surgery. Of course, turn around the next week, his IME shows up. Oh, a strange sprain. All right, now I went out and I found me a specialist, Dr. Tribal. Which is a well-known doctor in Portland. He's even actually partial owner of one of the hospitals out here. Saved one of the hospitals, I believe. It was Woodland Park closed. And he's got good credentials. And his diagnosis of me doesn't even come into play of what my... my worker at Safe doesn't even come in play of what he's saying. If you know, I'm denied benefits because, you know, I was denied my back protrusions, my disc protrusions. Okay, because the first IME said it was nothing but a strain sprain. Here, Dr. Tribal says, no, it's not just a strain sprain. You definitely have disc protrusions, and this is what the first IME doctor told me in his office. What he turned in was a whole second thing. All right, all of a sudden, I've only been in my case for 7 months. All of a sudden, they're sending me to another IME. And this IME, I've did a little research. This doctor's quite known for sending Safe what they want to hear. Okay, this does happen quite a bit. And I just got the report today from the second IME. and it's just totally ridiculous. Anybody with any kind of knowledge at all would just look at it and just laugh. You know, it's already proven that. Okay, I'm hurt. I'll switch to the last page, you know, right here. It says Mr. Allen's things are psychological. You know, there's nothing wrong with him. He's able to go back to work right now. Well, anybody in this room can come spend a day with me, and they'll see just the opposite. The reports from a Dr. Tribal, some of these reports, and as would
Mr. Allen, I'm going to ask you, I appreciate the situations that you find yourself in. I think you've made your point to the committee as to your concerns as to making sure that we have independent medical examiners that are trained, that they're close by, that we're not seeing patients being forced to travel undue distances, and making sure that people are qualified to perform those tests. Is there something else that you'd like to share with us?
Just one other point that I would like to share, and Senator Witz had a little bit to say about this. It was... are the workers informed of what they can do and what they can't do and who they can complain to and who they can't complain to? No, they're not. There's nothing on any of the forms other than the Ombudsman's paper that they send out. Now, I do believe that can be all be solved by just putting some advocacies on the Ombudsman's thing. Give the worker another resource. There's no other resources even in any pamphlets or anything for any other workers to even complain. If they have a complaint, they don't know where to go. So I believe that's a very legitimate thing that should be placed out. When you get your little packet, when you're hurt, it should be in there.
Okay. Mr. Allen, thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You guys too.
I want to call Ken Wells, Ernest, and I'm sorry I cannot DeMalazzo. It's Injured Workers Alliance, and also we'll go with that. Then I've got another panel that we'll do after that. Do you want to go ahead and state your name and go ahead and start?
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Ken Wells. I came in from Portland, and I more than likely risk sanctions from comp as far as I am one of the rare, rare people. I am doing a 21-month associate's degree program at Clackamas Community College. Right now I am carrying a 18-credit load. I am also, my GPA is a 3.462, so I'm up to date on my work, but I guess I should be at school, and I'm not. And so if somebody wants to come down on me, let's have at it. First of all, to look at IMEs, you're absolutely correct, Senator Breyer. It is in the glossary of the safe papers, their bylaws, their laws. It says insurer's medical examiner. The only reason that I made it as far as I did is because my injury happening on September 4th, 1999, I made it my life's work. All of that time, I've only worked 6 months. I made it my life's work to know what the laws are. I know how to take communicate with SAFE. I have been through to more IMEs than I would care to try to count. I went to my first IME was Anthony Woodward, and the man started out my nightmare. He completely twisted everything, came against me, and I had to start my fight from at that point because of the misconception that he gave SAFE as far as my injury. Then I had a doctor, Dr. Terrence Sedgwick, who was an orthopedic surgeon, a fine surgeon. He finally, it's my own opinion, caved into SAFE. And after I had one surgery from him, And then I wanted a second one. I wanted to have go out and have another look-see. They fixed the torn meniscus. I wanted another look-see. For 6 months, I asked him to because it progressively got worse. He finally told me that SAFE had written him a letter and said that I was malingering. When I started in checking things out, I find out that SAFE had not said anything, any such thing about me. That's where I have this conception that he caved in or was afraid to come up against SAFE. I had the I went back to work. I was released on a Thursday. I got a job on Monday. I went to work on Wednesday, and I worked for Helster Incorporated, which is a premier job shop. I'm a journeyman fabricator, mechanic. I've worked all my life. I've spent 16 years in Alaska, 10 years above the Arctic Circle as a bush dweller. I'm not afraid of work. And so I need to support my family. I don't work. They taken me in for another examination. The doctor reveals that he has not found has no reason to he can't understand why my knee has fallen apart as rapidly as it had.
It seems to me that we're going into more detail.
Okay, I will go skip beyond that.
That's what I need you to please do is limit your comments.
Okay.
I see that you registered a yes or for position for the bill. Do you have comments regarding the bill itself or the amendments that are before the committee at this point?
The bill, I think that they should have IMEs that we should be able to go to our own doctors, get the job. I think they ought to eliminate these hired guns that they have. I didn't feel moved to come here until I read all of the doctor's comments in references to IMEs. I would suggest that the IMEs also take and are held to their own the rules that we are to, that they are to be there on time and not to hold us up, which I've had happen. As far as the to throw in the being able to take and get any help, the ombudsman's for the for SAFE is not the place to go. Where you want to go is the sanctions unit, third floor. Those people are the pit bulls for anybody. They'll spank me, they'll spank you, they'll spank anybody. And I found out that they're honest people. I am totally against IMEs. I've only run into one, Stanley James. I had to drive all the way down here to Salem, and he's the only man that that has done any good. The rest of them have all created such a nightmare for me. If you will allot me just a brief moment here, this comes right from SAFE.
Mr. Wells,
yes.
If you want to submit that as written testimony,
right.
It's fine. We've got four of the bills today.
All right, I appreciate that. Thank you very much for the time. Appreciate it.
For yours. Any questions? Is it DeMazzo?
DeMazzo. Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is Ernie DeMazzo, and I'm Executive Director of Injured Workers Alliance. The IME system is not just have extreme bias, but it's a nightmare, and it's a complete fraudulent enterprise. Currently, Oregon statutes and administrative rules do not govern IMEs at all. But yet, when the injured worker receives the appointment to attend the IME, they are immediately told that their claim can be closed because of anything the IME says in regards to non-cooperation. And it does happen. Dr. Michael Freeman writes in Junk Science by IME Doctors, and he clearly spells out the difference between an attending physician, someone who's there to treat the person, and an IME. And he writes, the agent relationship for the provider of the IME is entirely different than for the healthcare provider. The IME provider has no ethical or fiduciary responsibility to the patient and has only to answer to the insurer who's requested the IME. He goes on to say that the future work of the IME is dependent on how well they please the insurance company, the person who's paying them. And he concludes that this situation, along with the lack of disciplinary consequences for untruthfulness, not only invites abuse, but it encourages it. Oregon is well known across the nation as the absolute worst state when it comes to IMEs. In fact, Oregon IMEs go around the country simply because they're notoriously always going to favor whoever's paying them. We have a system called the IME Arbiter System, which has worked quite well. It's administered by WCD. And even they make an interesting statement in their literature. They say, to avoid compromising the arbiter process, please, it states, do not refer to your examination as an IME insurer or independent medical exams. This is the dubious distinctions of IMEs. I've provided you approximately 20 solid evidence in regards to not only IME bias, but outright fraud. We have IME clinics, which you can see the paperwork there. One of them stated, we do not believe there should be anything independent about an independent medical evaluation. Doesn't get any clearer than that. Another one basically says that they are there to help the case management, and they understand the insurer's business needs.
Mr. DiMonzo, regarding the amendments that are before us, have you had a chance to look at those? And would you like to give us comment? It appears that you favor the bill. And so since you favor the bill, what I need is comment as to any issues that you might see that's coming from those amendments. If you haven't had a chance to review them, since you were kind enough to give us a pretty thick packet, maybe you could, in fact, review the dash ones, since those are being considered by the committee or will be considered by the committee for adoption.
Well, first of all, we didn't think that the IME bill went far enough. For one thing, there's about a 425-mile distance in the corners of Oregon to the city of Portland. Portland is the place that insurance companies send people for IMEs, simply because insurance companies don't like to take risks, and therefore they're going to send you to a place that they know they're going to get the opinion they want. That's fact. That's just how it works. If you've read the IME study, you will know point blank that the IME physicians themselves, that's the way they feel. 53% of them said there's insurer bias. The statements here are very powerful. I do hope you read it. Merle Campbell actually presents you with several of the quotes by the various participants. So again, before 1995, SB 369, there was a provision for distance. That was yanked. And as a result, picture it, 425 miles each way for a severely disabled person. We know workers who, because they have to stop so often, that it takes them 10 hours each way. The insurance companies do not provide expenses up front. In many cases, they do not provide hotels, rooms. Basically, workers are on their own. There's been a lot of talk about workers who don't show up for IME exams. I can tell you it's because they're driving 300 to 400 miles on a regular basis. Another problem we have with the bill, and again, we support the bill.
Also, what I'm going to ask you to do is put that in writing. I've got another 6 people on this bill alone. I've got another 4 bills that we're going to try to cover part of it today. And so I'm going to ask you to go ahead and put those in instead of taking the time and orally going over that, because I think it would be much more beneficial for all of us to be able to capture that in writing and be able to do a cross-check with what is coming up with the amendments.
In all due respect, Senator, we've been waiting a very long time for this. This bill's been needed for 30 years.
That's right. And the reality is we're going to have another hearing because we got another set of stuff. As I mentioned at the very beginning, I'm going to try to accommodate as many people as I can today. And if you want to come back the next time when we have the other stuff before us, we can take that up. But I'm telling you, I think one thing that would be beneficial for all of us is if you would like to articulate those issues in writing so we can be more prepared, because our time is limited, not only today, but at each of the hearings that we have, because there's many, many other issues besides this one, and this is one that we take very serious, but we want to make certain that we accommodate everyone else that's in this room.
It's also important to correct some of the misconceptions, in particular Senator Whitsett. The BME has steadily stated that because there's no doctor-patient relationship, they have very little authority. At the same time, injured workers coming to us and also going to the department have stated repeatedly that they've been bounced between the workers' comp division, the ombudsman, the BME, and, believe it or not, county prosecutors. This answers your question in regard to the BME. This bill will give the BME some authority because right now nobody has authority, and as a result, workers basically don't get their concerns addressed, and I did want to address that, and I did send you an email regarding BME's website, including their frequently asked questions, that essentially says they seldom get involved in these issues of IMEs. But I do thank the committee very much, and I hope we get to testify because, again, this has been a project since 1998, and we've been trying to get this changed, and we do support the bill, but we want to make sure this passes because we're concerned that it could be hijacked down the road.
We're going to do our best to make sure we get it before us where we can actually have a vote on it in this committee. If it's successful out of this committee, the reality is we'll have to go to Ways and Means for funding because of the cost. If it makes it out of Ways and Means, then it will go to the floor of the Senate, and then it will go to the House. So we will do everything that we can. I think there's a lot of people that are very sympathetic to the issues that are there. I can't give you a reason why it's taken, quote unquote, this long for it to be here, but it is here today. So what we ask you to do is if you have other things that you'd like to articulate in writing, I think it will help us all be able to understand it and gather it so we can actually move the bill forward.
Thank you very much, Senator. Are there any questions by chance?
I don't think so. Thank you for your
time.
Thank you. For the next panel, I have Linda, is it Barno? And Linda Jefferson. And I'm going to call Chris Davey up as well. No, I got another set. And it doubles up. Okay. If you'd like to start.
Senator Prezansky and members of the committee, I'm Linda Barno, co-chair of the Oregon Self-Insurance Association Legislative Committee. Along with me is my co-chair, Linda Jefferson. We're an organization of self-insurers and large deductible insurers that not only provide workers' compensation benefits to injured workers, but to co-workers. We're not only concerned about receiving a quality product that realistically addresses the issues at hand, but are aware of time frames, costs, and administrative issues. We've been a part of every MLAC meeting and subcommittee meeting on this issue. And we really applaud MLAC on listening to all parties that came to the table. There were things that we didn't like to hear, and there were things that we were able to give input on, and we really use this as a tool to improve the way that we operate in the state of Oregon also. We support all of MLAC's recommendations on SB 311. We have not been able to review in depth the latest amendments, and we did want to bring to the attention that in the bill it does not address the time frames when an issue is brought up on appeal. We have 60 days to accept or deny a claim, an aggravation claim, or a new or omitted claim. If there is an appeal process in place, what does that do to our accept-deny decision? So I think we need to look at that as to whether this would stay the decision until that appeal is been, you know, gone through its paces or what. And that's a critical piece on this. We also would like to take the time to digest page 2, lines 15 through 19, more carefully within our committee in the next day or two and get back to that. But in conclusion, this was a very non-cohesive question in the beginning. The study came out, there were a lot of feelings and everything, but I think as a group, labor, management, we all came together and came up with what I think is a good product in SB 311.
Ms. Barno, I'm going to also ask you, once you had a chance to go through the dash ones, if you have comments in writing, would be wonderful. It will give not only us the opportunity, but also the other interested parties that have been working on this the opportunity to hopefully accommodate what might need to still be covered.
Senator Prezanski, certainly we will do that.
Thank you. Ms. Jefferson, do you have something you'd like to share?
I have nothing in addition to Ms. Barnum's comments.
Okay.
Thank you.
And Mr. Davey?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Chris Davey of SAFE Corporation. I'll be very brief. Just to say that SAFE has consistently supported the work of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and in this case, I think Senate Bill 311 is an excellent example of the cooperation between management and labor on a controversial and complicated issue. And I think Senate Bill 311 will enhance the integrity of the IME process, and we support it.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much for coming forward. The last panel I have at this point is let's inquire George Goodman and Dan Farrington.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Independent, and I do want to stress Independent Medical Examination Association. With me today, to my left, immediate left, is George Goodman, the attorney for the association, and then to his left, Dan Farrington, CEO of Sunrise Medical Consultants. The IMEA formed in early January. As many as you know, the study prompted quite a bit of discussion. Therefore, our association formed in early January, so we were not participants in all of the MLAC subcommittee meetings, but once we formed, we were very active and have been very active and are here today to support Senate Bill, the concepts contained in Senate Bill 311. We have had a chance to review the amendments in depth and do have at least two comments of substantive nature. Our association includes a number of associate members in addition to nine organizations involved in facilitating IMEs throughout the state of Oregon. Our associate members include doctors, attorneys, self-insured employers, claims handling organizations, and other stakeholders interested in promoting high quality, and I want to stress again, independent medical input within Oregon's workers' compensation system. It's not often that you get a bunch of competitors joining up to join forces, so we, as Mr. Del Mazzo believes, this bill is somewhat significant. It's fairly significant for a bunch of competitors to get together and form an association to meet common goals. A couple of our association's goals that I do want to stress to the committee and get on the record are to participate in efforts to increase the quality of the IME process and product, assist in the creation of educational material for injured workers, IME doctors, claims handlers, and others involved in or affected by the IME process, and then serve as a clearinghouse and an advisory resource for the state and stakeholder groups with issues or concerns related to IMEs. We've been working very closely with both MLAC and Workers' Compensation Division to attempt to provide information and suggestions where we can, and have developed a very good working relationship with the Workers' Comp Division Administrator John Schiltz, and appreciate that very much. With respect to Senate Bill 311, I won't reiterate all of the points that we support. There are several concepts that were supported by MLAC that we are also supporting of primary importance. Number one, allowing Workers' Comp Division to establish, with the assistance of stakeholders, a list of qualified providers to conduct independent medical exams, and then also grounds for removal from that list. Allowing WCD to approve training and curriculum to be used by insurers and self-insured employers, third-party administrators, or other entities related to interactions with independent medical examination providers. And I'd like to stress the word interactions because that's part of our concern about a portion of the amendment. And then in number six, allowing a process within WCD to deal with and, where appropriate, change the location of independent medical examinations when objections are based on medical contraindication to travel and or other good causes shown. So with that, I'll turn my testimony over to Mr. Goodman, who would like to address two points in the Dash 1 amendments, but also would like to suggest to Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, to your point regarding the name of required medical exam, insurer medical exam, or independent medical exam. We would strongly support and suggest an amendment to all workers' compensation statutes to try to undo some of this perception of bias that may be created, to amend the statutes to clearly articulate that it is an independent medical exam. I don't think management would have any objection to that, and I actually asked former Representative Shipwreck, who was sitting in the back row and is now gone because he's left the room. Yeah. Everybody in this room knows probably where he went. If he had any issue with changing that name, and he said absolutely not, he did not. So we would strongly suggest that you entertain the notion to change the actual name from required and or insured to actually independent medical exam. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Goodman.
Good afternoon, Chairman Brzezinski, members of the committee. I am George Goodman. I do represent the Independent Medical Examination Association. The association has asked me, in light of your time constraints, to just focus on two issues in your Dash 1 amendments that we believe are not consistent with the concept papers and our attendance at the MLAC meetings. The first one appears on page 2, and it is found in lines 15 through 19, as referenced by Linda Barno on behalf of the Oregon Self-Insurers Association. Same lines. We do believe that our written submission on page 2 under number 6 contains the concept as we understood it coming out of MLAC, and the difference being in line with what Senator Barra was talking about earlier. The language in Dash 1 gives what would appear to be unfettered discretion to the department to create any rules and any process they want with regard to consideration of travel issues. We understood that that unfettered discretion was supposed to be guided by statute as to how it was to be exercised and utilized, and that is why number 6 in our written submission is written as it is. And I believe after the at least the people that I've spoken to on MLAC this afternoon, after they've had a chance to look at Dash 1, when you next hear from them, you may hear that they too have issues with the way that lines 15 through 19 were drafted. The second issue is on page 3 at lines 18 and 28. Twice the word conducting is used in reference to medical examinations. It is only the doctors that conduct medical examinations. It is not the claims handlers. It is not the claimants. It is not the associations that are arranging or being the broker for these examinations. That is the wrong word, and I think will create significant confusion and perhaps litigation down the road. We would suggest that, as Ms. Squires testified to, that word be deleted and it be substituted with the words interactions with, because that is what we were talking about, interactions with providers of medical examinations or independent medical examination providers, either one, because that's the relationship that is sought to be affected by the rules and the training, is how the claims handlers and others interact with the providers of medical examinations. We think that will more accurately reflect the intent of what came out of MLAC. And with that, I thank you and will entertain any questions, should you have any.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Thank you very much. I also have Scott Gallant that wanted to testify. Mr. Gallant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association. Unlike others, we've had a very quick look at the draft amendments that are presented to you today, and I'll be very brief in my comments. First of all, I don't actually believe that it is clear in the draft amendments who, in fact, would be responsible for determining medical standards under the provisions of this legislation. Clearly, the bill provides broad discretion to the Workers' Comp Division, both in sanctions and in determining standards of ethics and professional activities, and it is not elucidated in the bill what that means, who has jurisdiction, nor whether a physician who might, in the sanction provisions of the bill, be removed from a panel, whether that would be submitted to the National Practitioner Data Bank, which has implications for a physician's ability to practice medicine in this state. And that would I believe, need significant clarification. As I understand the outline from the department, they would also be able to, the department could and will require attending physicians to provide written acknowledgement they've reviewed reports with their patient, with the exception of psychiatric examinations. I'm not sure what the sanctions are if that does not occur, or if a patient says they would prefer not to review the report. It's not outlined in the bill, nor is there any indication how they would assure that that does in fact occur. I assume the department would review workers' comp records in the process, and I would suggest that that will end up being a fairly expensive process. The bill also says that there is a sanction for diagnostic tests not being delivered in a timely manner, which is not defined. As many of you know, often diagnostic tests are conducted out of the state, and I'm not quite sure how this bill intends to address out-of-state diagnostic entities if those tests are not received in a timely manner. Again, the bill doesn't define what timely is in the process, and I think you need to consider that as well. The legislature many years ago, when then Representative Shiprock was on Ways and Means and other committees, did in fact adopt a requirement for continuing education for physicians who participated in workers' comp. It was the OMA and the department worked in concert to put together a videotape in the process so that physicians would certify by sending in a card that they in fact viewed the tape, et cetera, et cetera. It was universally disliked by physicians and originally was opposed by the OMA. We subsequently sought legislation to have it repealed and did have it repealed under a previous administration. The bill also says that there will be input from the Medical Advisory Committee. In our opinion, that's about all it's worth. It provides no assurance that there is any consideration by the department of any kind of input from the advisory committee. I've been in this business a very long time and done a lot of rulemaking hearings. This is not to say that the department would ever just ignore recommendations, but the administrative rules process is very, very different in providing, as I tell my father on occasion, who says I never follow his advice. I said that's what's great about being an adult. I appreciate the advice, but I don't necessarily have to take it. And again, this bill most certainly provides the department with great discretion in regard to that. And my final comment one of the circumstances the state finds itself in is that we're on either in the middle of or soon to be in the middle of or later into a physician manpower shortage. And the more mandatory requirements you put on physicians and physician offices to perform services that in a lot of instances, particularly in this arena, are legal issues, the less and less they are going to participate, and more you're likely to discourage well-qualified physicians to participate in this program. Other than that, Mr. Chairman, we love this bill.
Mr. Gallin, I just wanted to ask you that. I'm glad you brought that point up, because you hadn't signed up before, so you sat back and wanted, I guess, hear where we're going. What is your position on the bill? I mean, is it something you're sincere that you do support the changes that are going forward with these?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have been flippant. No, I believe the bill, as currently amended, needs significant improvement. It needs definitive clarity on what it means, what kind of jurisdiction the department has, whether or not the jurisdiction of setting ethical and professional standards is in fact the jurisdiction of the Workers' Comp Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, or whether it is in fact the jurisdiction of the Board of Medical Examiners, where there are at least 37 different ways to sanction a physician by suspension of licensure, loss of licensure, or any number of other activities. And I'm not sure that this bill provides the clarity that makes the determination of, excuse me, of whether the department is going to be getting into the business of determining the standard of practice in medicine that could be, in fact, in conflict with the Board of Medical Examiners.
So, Mr. Gallant, has you or anyone else in your in the OMA participated in this process?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And were these concerns raised at that time?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that some discussion of what impact these things may have been raised, not directly to MLAC. I know that I testified before a subcommittee of MLAC last interim and raised a number of concerns about mandatory continuing education, our position on in regard to that, setting standards of care.
Let me ask
care.
That's back, seems like, maybe...
Mr. Chairman, last month was a long time.
Yeah. So have you participated in the most recent discussions?
My associate has been going to the MLAC meetings, Mr. Chairman, and I believe that we had our chairman go, Dr. Silver, who's a neurosurgeon, attend a recent hearing from the MLAC.
Are you all going to continue to participate in this process?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to do that.
Any other questions for Mr. Gallant?
Just one quick question, Chair Pozanski. Mr. Gallant, do you have an idea of how many complaints the OBEB has logged in the last, say, 2 years from medical examiners regarding medical examinations, independent medical examination proceedings?
Mr. Chairman, no, I'm not.
Can you find that out, please?
I'd certainly make an inquiry. Absolutely.
And I have one follow-up based on that, I guess. It's my understanding, as the law is currently written, or the rules are currently written, as it may be, that when there is an individual that's going through this workers' comp system, if they have a concern about their doctor or physician, he or she, how something is, has played out, that the department does in fact have the authority and I guess duty to report to the Board of Medical Examiners the issues that they deem needs to be reviewed. Is that a process that actually seems to accommodate the needs of making certain that the physicians are, I guess, given an opportunity to redress whatever issues that might be raised against them? Or do you think there needs to be another means for physicians to have that input?
Mr. Chairman, I assume you mean within the Workers' Comp Division in their process or with the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners?
Well, it's my understanding that under the Workers' Comp, that the Workers' Comp Division does refer complaint mm-hmm. to the Board of Medical Examiners. And what my question is, what I'm hearing is that your concern as to doctors being sanctioned inappropriately through this process. And I guess two things. Number one, it seems to me I've not heard that that's happening today under the current system, and that there is a working relationship between the department and the Board of Medical Exam to actually delegate what is really the appropriate, I guess, venue for those type of complaints, which would be the Board of Medical Examiners.
Mr. Chairman, I guess there are two answers to this question, or maybe one answer with three part or two to three parts. One is most certainly any agency can file a complaint with the Board of Medical Examiners, and they will be investigated, and it does happen. Every physician is obligated under the law to report any physician who they believe is committing fraud, inappropriately meeting standard of practice, etc. My third response is, as I understood the testimony, the only sanction that department verbally said they are seeking is the ability to, well, to do two things, actually. One is to pull a physician off of the IME list, and they would not be able to provide independent medical examinations or whatever they're going to be called in the future. But the bill also provides for civil penalties, as I understand the amendments, and I'm not sure whether they're as limited as it appears. And we'll have our counsel look at that in more detail.
And could you also have counsel look at the appeal process? Because I believe there is an appeal process, that it's not just ceremoniously that someone's removed. I think there is a process that, under administrative rule, would require them to have the opportunity to do that. Plus, they could always go through the legal process if they deemed that appropriate, once they've extinguished their administrative revenue or relief.
Mr. Chairman, I do appreciate that, and again, I just caution that the kind of disincentives that we create could be very serious in my opinion in this process. Thank you.
Thank you. That I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 311, and we're going to take a little moment here to see. This is not even. Karen, we're going to take a short recess. Go ahead and go on. We've looked at the schedule, looking at the time that we have now. I'm going to continue to take some testimony on the next bill, which is Senate Bill 386. But what I'm going to do is, because there's other people here on other bills that seem not to be, let's say, companion bills or similar related as 311 or 386, we're going to take Senate Bill 573. We're going to carry that one over, as well as Senate Bill 935, and we're going to carry them over to Tuesday, March 15th. So Senate Bill 573 and 935 will be carried over to March 15th, and we are not going to be taking public testimony today on Senate Bill 944. What slot do we want to put it in for now? And what we're going to do is we're going to tentatively place it on the agenda for March 24th. That's only a tentative. You should stay in touch. Remember, we have 48-hour posting rules, so it could change, meaning that it could be earlier than the 24th. But I can put it, well, rest assured, based on the commitments of this committee and obligations of other committees that we have, that we will not have those other two advance in the agenda, but they will be on the 15th. So with that said, we're going to start testimony on Senate Bill 386. And I'm going to go ahead and ask John Soltz to please come back up, since you'll be laying up the parameters of the bill. And is there anyone else, John, that would be appropriate to be up at the table with you?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. I believe J.L. Wilson is still here, a member of the Management Labor Advisory Committee.
Okay.
Co-chair.
J.L., if you'll please come up. And is anyone besides the two of you for this panel?
I think we're it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, excuse me.
Oh, and how about Bob Shipwreck? He's back.
Sorry, Bob.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the Senate Commerce Committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson with NFIB Oregon, and also co-chair of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. Senate Bill 386, amending our permanent total disability laws, was part of our three-part MLAC agenda. This bill is remarkable for a number of reasons, not the least of which this is a bill which management is in good faith working out with our friends on the labor side, addressing an inequity in PTD payments that arises from a court case, primarily the T versus Albertson case, which allowed for rescission of PTD benefits if you had any sort of gainful occupation at all. And the T versus Albertson case basically allowed that if you could work 1 hour for any amount of wage that your PTD benefit could in fact be rescinded. So management comes to the table knowing that this is going to be a system increase, but we do so because it is a basic inequity in the law, and we're willing to work that component out. John will, or Mr. Schultz will, go over the specifics of the statute, but I want to tell the committee a couple things. First of all, this is a significant work in progress, because when you start to tackle PTD payments, I'm absolutely amazed at the number of issues that blossom out of that, and extensions of issues that you never even knew existed that you have to hammer out. And that having been said, there are still some outstanding issues in the bill. We're still talking about hammering out a definitive agreement on the definition of gainful occupation. Another issue would be if a worker can work part-time and they are injured while receiving a PTD benefit, they're also working part-time and get injured at the part-time job. Is there any offset to their PTD award by virtue of receiving time loss for the injury on the second job? PTD workers who are receiving that benefit, if they work part-time, we have yet to iron down if there's going to be any limit to earnings that's prescribed in that situation. We have to iron out the definition of quote-unquote regular work, and the definition of medical and vocational material improvement is still unclear. That's just to say there are a host of issues that we're close to coming to consensus on, but understanding that the process needs to be moved along, we have come to agreement on a vast majority of the bill, and that should be reason for this committee to favorably consider this bill and move it along, because this is the long process and these details will be hashed out. There are a few outstanding issues, but we negotiate that in good faith, and we believe that there will be a bill, and it will be something that we can agree on.
Thank you. Bob or John, whoever.
I'm quicker. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Bob Shiprack, co-chair of Management Labor Advisory Committee and Building Trades Representative. I'll echo what JL has told the committee, just add as I did on previous testimony. This work began again coming from legislators asking us to take a look at some problems with the work comp system, and of course members of the public. Once again, a study was conducted by the Department of Real People. I again don't know if this committee saw the results of that study. If not, it is available from the department to take a look at some of the issues surrounding what are known as rescissions of PTD, in effect taking that benefit away, suspending those benefits. And out of that came this bill, and I think JL and the rest of the management folks did recognize that there is, mainly because of that court decision, that frankly I didn't know about it at the time it passed. And so I'm glad we did the research. We've looked at this program. This will make a much fairer system for injured workers who, I just wanted my last comment that really brought this home to me. These people have severe medical and oftentimes psychological problems due to their workplace injuries. These are the tough cases. We're not talking about a lot of people here, but we, the society and the legislature, owes something to these people. And again, this is something that you can all be proud of. Thank you very much.
John. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, I'm John Schultz, the Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer Business Services, and I'm here today to request the committee's support for SB 386 and the -1 amendments. What I plan to do is just touch very briefly on my written testimony and then go through the proposed amendments, the -1s, and I'd be very happy to answer any question along the way. The bill is basically designed to address two different areas of permanent total disability law under workers' compensation. The first addresses where to set a threshold to determine what constitutes gainful employment. Mr. Shiprack talked about the T versus Albertson's case. That was a very important bit of case law for workers' compensation because it essentially defined gainful employment as anything a worker could regularly work, and that means just a few hours a week. If they can regularly work it and earn minimum wage, even for a few hours a week, they're considered to be gainfully employed and therefore not eligible for permanent total disability benefits. What SB 386 and the Dash 1 amendments do is redefine gainful employment as a wage that pays a worker equal to or better than the current United States Department of Health and Human Services federal poverty guideline for a family of three. Currently, that's about $1,340 a month. The second thing that this bill does, as JL and Bob indicated, was it addresses the process for rescinding permanent and total disabilities. Currently, insurers have authority, and that was based on a previous bill that we had brought forward. Insurers have the authority to rescind permanent total disability benefits. What we found was that we needed to put some guidelines in place to assure that the rescinds were occurring on workers that really needed their permanent total disability benefits rescinded. And so I have covered that in my testimony, what that looks like. It basically starts on the bottom of page 2 and goes through the first half of page 3 in my written testimony. And if you'd like, Mr. Chair, I can go through that or I can just go to the amendments to save time.
Let me ask, does anyone want any more detail besides the amendments? Why don't we go to the amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, just a note on the amendments. Sections 2 and Section 4 are sunset provisions, again, so they're going to mirror the language in Section 1 and Section 3. So I'll skip those two as I go through this. If you have the amendments in front of you, the first thing I want to bring to your attention is on line 2 on page 1 that we deleted based on family size and inserted for a family of 3. And that was something specific that MLAC very recently decided to do. They wanted to get as specific about the wage threshold as possible. And we had originally adopted the entire Health and Human Services federal poverty threshold, which had a variety of family sizes in it. The Management Labor Advisory Committee realized that was going to cause other technical problems inside of workers' compensation, and so decided to select one wage threshold. On line 5, is the start of a very long amendment that basically talks about if a worker is found to be materially improved, a worker who is permanently and totally disabled is found to be materially improved and capable of regularly performing work at a gainful and suitable occupation, it goes into the process of the insurer issuing the notice of closure and the appeals process that the workers must follow if they're going to appeal that decision, as well as the extension of permanent total disability payments through that appeals process and how that works. The Management Labor Advisory Committee in this bill have decided that the workers need to continue to receive permanent and total disability benefits essentially until their permanent and total disability rescind has been reviewed by an administrative law judge of the Hearings Division of the Workers' Compensation Board and that rescind has been affirmed. And that's essentially what this section goes into. On page 2, on line 4, is a concept that talks about greater weight being given to reports and evaluations that in the amendment, it talks about those that aren't based on the personal observation by the author. The idea here, if you read the entire section of the bill, is to give greater weight to reports for the purpose of rescinding permanent total disabilities to examiners who have actually personally observed and examined the worker over examiners who are doing file reviews. And this was something that came out in the study that Mr. Shiprack referred to. We realized that there was no differentiation between those types of examiners, and it was concluded that greater weight needed to be given to examiners who actually review the worker and see them. Page 2 again, lines 7 through 11, the amendment really refers to that if a worker
if their rescind has become final, in other words, it has been affirmed at a higher level than the insurer's first rescinding of the benefit, the worker becomes eligible for vocational assistance benefits through the workers' compensation process. And this was a recognition by the Management Labor Advisory Committee that many insurance companies already do this, but they're not required to. And this would just bring consistency to the process. It would require that all workers who have their permanent total disability benefit taken away, and we looked in the survey, a lot of these workers had been on permanent total disability benefits for over a dozen years. Many of those workers, their impairment may be improved, but their disability, which is actually a combination of their impairment and their interaction with their social environment, may not be improved. And vocational assistance is something that's going to help them. At the time that vocational assistance ends, this section goes on to say that the insurer or self-insured employer shall determine the extent of disability at that time pursuant to 656.214. And that's actually a reference to permanent partial disability benefits. And so the worker would be looked at again at that time to determine if they needed permanent partial disability compensation, but it would not allow for another review of permanent disability compensation, permanent total disability compensation, because that would have just been rescinded and affirmed by an administrative law judge. And it was Management Labor Advisory Committee's decision not to go through that process again. On line 12 through 28, there's another pretty long section in here, and that really refers to workers being required to submit to a vocational evaluation that is at a time reasonably convenient to the worker. This actually mirrors the required medical examination language that we're not planning to change in SB 311, and it just requires workers to participate in a vocational evaluation. This was brought up by insurers, and the Management Labor Advisory Committee realized that there was nothing to compel workers in present law to actually participate in an evaluation of their vocational status, and that is a very important part of determining whether they're still permanent and total disability or should be permanent and total disability. So this actually compels workers to attend those evaluations. Jumping ahead on page 3, down on lines 27 and 28, I already covered this. This is the sunset section that I've already covered. Just referring to the vocational eligibility. And I believe that is all I was going to cover on the amendments. I think that gets to the main amendments on this bill.
Great. Thank you. Questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
On page 1 of the amendments, on line 6, where they're materially improved and capable of regularly performing work at a gainful and suitable occupation, how would that rule out the scenario you gave earlier where someone could be regularly working but for a very short period of time?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, the definition of gainful would be changed so that gainful employment would now actually be based on an occupation that is going to provide the worker with income equal to or greater than the federal poverty line.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Just looking at our list, Mr. Hector, you're on here. Did you want to say a few words? Please, come on up. And let's see, Lisa Trussell, I have you down, but you didn't put a position, so you want to give me a position so we figure Lisa's left.
I took her spot.
Okay. Mr. Hector, before, JL, are you leaving or are you going to stay? Can I just ask you, did Ms. Trussell ask you to speak on her behalf? The statements, can we attribute those to her as well? I just want to know if AOI had an issue.
Thank you. What Lisa wanted me to convey and what we would convey anyways were just the outstanding issues left to be settled, and that is the extent of it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hector.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, from the record, my name is Ken Hector. I'm a member of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, serving on the management side, and also a member of the Senate Bill 386 Subcommittee. Just one additional point, Mr. Wilson went through those points that are still unresolved, and there's one additional one that I think goes right back to what Senator Burdick had just queried about, and that was with respect to gainful employment. As you've heard, the standard would be a family of three at the federal poverty level guideline. The unresolved issue is, however, for a person whose earnings have never reached that level. In other words, people who might, by either desire or circumstance, work part-time, whose earnings might be substantially below that. And we are still working to come to a grips on how we will deal with that, because that would certainly be artificial for somebody, for example, who had never earned more than $8,000, would by definition then be a permanent total, even though they could continue to work and earn $8,000 or more dollars. So we're working to somehow come up with some language that will take care of that issue, and that's the only thing I wanted to add in addition.
All right. Mr. Hector, I've got, I guess, a mixed message here as to, I'm hearing that we've got this ready with Dash Ones. We feel comfortable in knowing there's new additional work to be done. Is it the position of MLAC that they want to try to resolve these remaining issues before the bill moves forward?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
We know the bill has to go forward. Our next meeting is not till the 17th, and we would hope to have be able to answer all those questions at the MLAC meeting on the 17th and get them to you promptly.
Okay. Thank you. And so you said your next meeting is 17th of this month?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Hector?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to call up, and again, let me ask before I call you up, Linda Barno and Linda Jefferson, you're both listed here. Did y'all want to give testimony? And if so, was this in support or in opposition?
Just myself, and it would be in support of.
Okay, Ms. Jefferson, why don't you please come on up. Mr. Egan, please come on up.
Mr. Chair, maybe we need a clarification, because I now have a mixed message. I thought that they testify and move the bill forward and we'll address it or continuing issues in the House.
Yeah.
Hector said bill. So I'm confused now.
Yeah. Mr. Hector, why don't you come back up before we take this next testimony? Just want to get clarification if we could.
We want to make sure Mr. Hector's right between us.
So there you go. Get him from both sides here. Mr. Hector, I mean, I know the way I asked the question may not have been as clear. It should have been. What we understand is that because of the time restraints we have and the time restraints your committee has, that you anticipate that we may move the bill forward while you continue to work on it?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. I believe that is consistent with what Mr. Wilson was saying, that we recognize there is a time frame that you need to move with, but we will bring in this additional information forward and to catch up whenever is appropriate.
Okay. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Ms. Jefferson.
Yes, for the record, my name is Linda Jefferson. I co-chair the Oregon Self-Insured Association's Legislative Committee. And I would just like to state for the record that OSIA is in support of the Management Labor Advisory Committee's original objective of addressing the issue of rescinding permanent total disability benefits. We also are in support of Senate Bill 386. We have not had the opportunity to fully evaluate the amendments before this afternoon's hearing, but one of the issues that is of critical importance to the OSIA is the issue of the definition of gainful occupation, and so our full support is contingent on the ultimate outcome of that definition. We do have some additional discussion items that we have presented to the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and we would like to continue to work with them on, and that's with regards to defining regular work and essential functions as part of this bill to help to clarify throughout the statute exactly what those terms mean, and particularly for Senate Bill 386, what it means with regard to permanent total disability benefits. So if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Any questions?
Yes. I'd just like to clarify what we're talking about now is we know the bill isn't perfect, but because of our time constraints,
to move the bill with additional amendments now and with the knowledge that the House would refine these issues. Is that what you're telling us you would support? Or is your support based on the bill stays here until it's
Senator Prezanski and the committee, I would say that we support that the bill moves forward. I think we have all reached consensus that the majority of the aspects of the bill are appropriate to move forward, and we will continue to work on fine-tuning the remaining issues with the committee. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Prezanski, members of the committee, I'm Jimmy Egan. I practice law in Albany, and I live in the metropolitan area of Tangent, Oregon. So I'm here to testify in favor of the bill. I've written remarks which I've distributed for your review. My hope is that placing the comments in the record will allow me to just focus and abbreviate my comments. The issue raising the most controversy has to do with the definition of gainful occupational. There is a fundamental misunderstanding as to the effect of imposing the federal poverty level for a family of three as a definition for gainful employment among the players. Whether a person is married or single, rich or poor, or any other status will not affect the award under the standard. In essence, all the new definition for gainful employment will do is to establish a consistent burden of proof for all claimants. They will all have to prove that they are no longer capable of earning minimum wage 40 hours a week, or about $1,300 per month, in order to receive an award of permanent total disability. Let's take a real quick scenario. If a single mother is a student out here at Chemeketa Community College, and she's earning $500 or $600 a month to supplement her income to get through college, and she has a devastating injury and she becomes permanently and totally disabled, okay, and she's earning $600 a month, her award of permanent total disability will be about $400 a month. Doesn't matter whether she's capable of earning $1 million a month or $100 a month. It doesn't make any difference whether her potential is to earn $1 million a month or $100 a month prior to this injury. After the injury, if she proves in a hearing that she can no longer earn $1,300 per month, then she is awarded her $400 per month. This won't affect the amount of money that's distributed to permanently and totally disabled workers. It just creates a threshold for proof. Under the T decision, the Betty T decision versus Albertson that they talked about earlier, if an injured worker is capable, is bedridden, and is only capable of telephone solicitations on a part-time basis when she's in and out of consciousness, as long as she's capable of earning minimum wage during those moments of consciousness, she's not permanently and totally disabled under our system. It's nuts. It's insane. So the bottom line is, what we're doing here is we're creating a threshold that's common among all injured workers, and that's $1,305 and some change. We are in favor of, as at the Oregon Trial Lawyers, that's who I'm representing today, we're in favor of that bright line threshold standard. We think the threshold ought to be higher, but we're willing to compromise because right now Betty T basically eliminates permanent and total disability in this state. I can show you that it eliminates permanent total disability in this state by showing you the figures from 2001. During 2001, we awarded -1 permanent total disabilities in the state. -1. In other words, we took more away than we gave. Now, we killed more injured workers than that. And 49 of the other states, devastating injuries outnumber the number of deaths in every other state but Oregon. But in Oregon, we have fewer permanent total disabilities than we have deaths. That's a flip-flop. It's a legal fiction. We've created a system where permanent total disability only happens where it benefits insurance carriers. In this particular case, we think that the definition of gainful employment ought to be right at the poverty level for a family of three. It only creates a burden of proof for injured workers. It doesn't create an amount of money that will be paid injured workers. It has nothing to do with anything other than the burden of proof which injured workers will be able to, or will have to show. I have summarized my testimony in written form. We are in favor of the five major aspects of the legislation. We're very happy with the -1 amendments, and we will continue to work with MLAC and everybody else. To answer Senator Byer's question of the earlier testimony or earlier witness, we are in favor of moving this thing along. We'll continue to work with MLAC and with all the committees with regard to changes.
Thank you. Any questions? All right.
see, the only people I've left, I think, who still need to testify is Chris Davey, who's signed up as neutral, and Dan Holden, who's in opposition. Mr. Holden, why don't you go ahead and go first?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Holden. I'm the Workers' Compensation Administrator for City County Insurance Services. I guess to say that I'm in opposition may not be accurate. It's the box I checked, but once I heard others testify before me, I think I'll just very quickly sort of reiterate what they said. On behalf of City County Insurance, we were concerned that the bill was not in a proper form to be moved forward, but after listening to the testimony and understanding that it can be, MLAC can continue to work on the bill as it moves forward, then we're in agreement with that. And so very briefly, I just wanted to make that statement that we're in favor of that.
Okay. Mr. Holden, thank you. Not Mike Egan. Relieve some concerns after Mr. Davey speaks.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation, and again, as in our testimony on the previous bill, we commended the work of the Management Labor Advisory Committee for taking on a difficult issue. This bill will increase some benefits to injured workers, and we think that's an appropriate thing to do. And again, just to clarify the box that I checked there as being neutral, it was simply because this is still a work in progress, and I'm quite confident that by the time the Management Labor Committee gets through with their work, we'll move from that neutral box into the favorable box.
All right, great. Thank you. Any questions for the panel? All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. That's all I have on individuals who want to give testimony. Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Senator. Chris Warren signed up for this bill. Ernest Del Mazo.
It's not on here, but you're here. Feel free to sit down.
I just have a few comments to make. Injured Workers Alliance. Again, my name is Ernest Del Mazo. I'm a co-founder, executive director of Injured Workers Alliance, a statewide advocacy group. We do support 386. I want to make it very clear that there has been serious problems in this area. Workers' Compensation Division did a study, and they presented it to MLAC in 2001. And that study found that the workers' compensation system only replaced 42% of the paycheck lost in the first 10 years, in the 10 years following a disabling workplace injury. Obviously, 42% is a pretty low number. At the same time, again, you heard the minus one in 2001. That just happened to be the first year of insurer determination. And essentially what we had is before the changes in 1995, Oregon saw generally 100 to 200 PTDs. Now, again, that rate has been in a single digit since those changes in 1995, and we do lag seriously behind other states. To go from 100 to 200 to single digit is a pretty big step down. There's also another issue that should be part of this bill. There was a decision in December of 2000. Basically, it's Cresquella versus Willamette Industries, Inc. And what the court found is the post-1995 statutory scheme for assessing whether a worker should receive a award of PDD benefits fails to satisfy procedural due process requirements. We're talking about the 14th Amendment right to the U.S. Constitution and Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution. Article 14 being the U.S. Basically, it's procedural due process rights. And for some reason, believe it or not, our statutes still do not comply with this court ruling. It involves both the U.S. and Oregon Constitution. There was legislation in 2001 that addressed this. Went nowhere. There was both a Senate bill and a House bill 2 years ago, and the House bill simply addressed this issue and one minor issue involving whether injured workers could receive their medical reports. Unfortunately, that bill went nowhere. even though it would, you would think that an insurance company would abide by the Supreme Court ruling, as Cascello is very well known, there's actually cases out there where they're still fighting claims over Cascello. And it's a pretty sad commentary. There's absolutely no reason why this portion could not be included in this bill. It just makes sense. I mean, our statutes should comply with the Oregon and U.S. Supreme Court. We would like to see that added to this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. What I'd ask you to do is, if you could be so kind to put that in writing so we can look at it and see if it actually fits a relating clause that we have. More than likely, it will not be in this bill. I've got I've made a decision that we're going to move this bill forward once we get the other adjustments that need to be done. So I'm going to close the public hearing now, but if you'll get that, your choices would be one of two things. One, we'll see if there's something else that we can maybe work with that in here. If it's something that needs to be done, we'll ask our legal counsel as to what needs to be done once we get your recommendations. And if you want to address this regarding this particular bill on the House side, if we can't address it in another way, then you can do that as well.
Thank you very much, Senator.
I'm going to close the public hearing on this bill, which is Senate Bill 386, and I guess we'll make the statement we are not going to move the bill today. My understanding is that the full MLAC committee will be meeting on the 17th. It's my understanding this is basically the sub has already reached an agreement. It just has to get the approval. Barring any exceptions to that, I expect that we will be able to get those amendments to LC that same day, and that we will have it back for work session on the following Tuesday, which will be March 22nd. So work session March 22nd, I expect LC will have cleared their backlog, and they should be able to turn out the amendments if they get them on Thursday. John, I know that you're here and you're listening, and I'm hoping that you'll take the lead in getting those to LC, and counsel will be able to help you do that if you need any assistance to getting into LC. Is there any other? I guess the only thing that we need to talk about is for our travel on Thursday. And my thought, based on the timing, is that we probably need to plan on trying to leave about 3:15.
That's okay. Karen said 3:10.
3:10. Okay. So regular time, and we got directions on
that. We have a van that will be parked in the loading zone, and we have directions we will hand out here, Elliot.
Okay, and so.
What's that?
Loading in the back.
That's the back of the building, right?
Right. Over on State Street.
I just wanted to make sure that
we okay, so we'll be surface level State Street. If there's nothing else, I want to thank.
Senator, are you planning, is this an overnight or are you coming back?
No, we'll be coming back.
You're coming back.
Okay. If you want to stay overnight,
I think what I will do is drive and go on down to Klamath. I've got some things to do there.
I understand. We're close the committee's work for today.